Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is this year's recipient of the Tulsa Library's 2016 Sankofa Freedom Award, broadcaster, author, and advocate Tavis Smiley, who hosts a weeknight television talk show on PBS, as well as a weekly public radio program. Smiley is also the author of a number of books, including My Journey with Maya, the story of his 28-year friendship with Maya Angelou, Death of the King, the real story of Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year, The Rich and the Rest of Us, written with Cornel West, his memoir, which was a bestseller, What I Know for Sure, and his 2006 bestseller, The Covenant with Black America, which offered essays and action plans for eliminating disparities in African Americans' access to health care, education, criminal justice, economic opportunities, and about five other areas. His latest book, The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later, published earlier this month, revisits that covenant and has found an overall worsening of these disparities. Smiley will receive the Sankofa Freedom Award Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. He'll be lecturing and signing books at Rudisill Regional Library, and that is free to the public. He's also been in the news significantly in recent weeks for his comments about the new book, that Black Americans should be holding the Obama administration to a greater share of responsibility in the lack of gains over the past decade, and his indictment of the news media for failing to report critically on presidential candidate Donald Trump's racially and ethnically divisive language on the campaign trail, to which Trump responded by calling Smiley a racist. I spoke with Smiley yesterday afternoon before Trump made his announcement that he was pulling out of the latest presidential debate. Tavis Smiley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations on the library's Sankofa Freedom Award.
Thank you for saying that, and thank you for the opportunity to be on your program, Rich.
Before we talk about your latest book, The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later, I do want to ask you about your recent moment in the presidential news cycle a couple of weeks ago. I know you've been asked about this a lot, but you called out the media's uncritical coverage of Donald Trump's trying to appeal both overtly and covertly to racially and ethnically divisive messages. And of course, Trump responded by calling you a racist. But first, how should the media be covering his campaign critically about these, whether they're dog whistles or overt messages?
Sure. Great question. Great place to start. I think that, and I've tried to intimate as such, I think that Trump is being covered by the media, no doubt about that, Rich. He's being covered, but he's not being challenged. He's being covered, but he's not being condemned. And someone might ask, is that our role? Well, in the media, it is our role to condemn if the person running is playing to the dark side of America, playing to the night side of America, if they're expressing xenophobic behavior, if they're having Muslims and African Americans, you know, kicked out of their rallies. This is unacceptable. It is absolutely anti-American. And for the media to sit back and act as if Donald Trump is just wondrously and magically ascending in the polls and disconnect that or not connect that to how and why that's happening, then we're not telling the whole story. Let's be honest. The media loves this. The mainstream media, that is, the corporate media loves this. People are making money. They're getting ratings. They're selling newspapers. Donald Trump is making money for a lot of people right now. And we love the fact that it's unpredictable. We got to fight on the left. We got to fight on the right. There are many news organizations, some individuals certainly, who stop covering these Democratic and Republican conventions every 4 years because, as you know, Rich, they're so predictable. There's no news really being made. And so this is something that we haven't had in a long time. There's been a pile up on the establishment highway. And so the fact that these outsiders, as it were, Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, are polling in the way that they are makes this exciting for all of us. And I'm okay with that. I'm somewhat tickled by the fact that the establishment is having some difficulty this time around. But that doesn't mean that these folks should be covered and that we should cover them without putting a critical laser-like lens on what they're saying, on what they're doing, that's allowing them to succeed. And finally, it's as if there is a, how might I put this, Rich, the relationship between Donald Trump and the media is classic codependency. It's not even just codependency, it's quid pro quo. It's like, Donald, you give us and we'll give you. And so he can say anything and do anything and get away with it because we are just excited about the fact that it's fun to watch this race, but it's more to it than that, for me at least.
It seems like it's turning presidential politics into a reality show.
It absolutely is, and that's what Donald Trump is. He's an entertainer. and I'm not suggesting that, you know, that Trump doesn't have the right to run or that people shouldn't listen to him or pay attention to what he has to say and judge him for who he is and for what he's saying. I'm just suggesting that the media is so titillated by, you know, this his presence in the race that nobody's asking. I was laughing a few weeks ago. I was watching the Sunday morning shows one day, and I've seen this happen a couple of times. Donald Trump doesn't join these Sunday morning shows by satellite feed. He doesn't even join, obviously, in person. This guy calls into the Sunday morning shows. I mean, who does that? I've never in my life seen candidates for presidency call into on their cell phone Sunday morning talk shows, and they're so giddy to have him on, even on the phone. And he calls in, and he bullies, and he blusters, and he's boastful and braggadocious and all that stuff. You don't really get to any real issues, but the fact that they're letting him literally phone it in on these Sunday morning newsmaker shows is just further evidence that nobody wants to ask this guy any tough questions.
Why do you suppose they don't want to ask him tough questions? Because it's better political theater?
Sure, it's better political theater. As I mentioned earlier, there's money being made, it's ratings, it's newspapers being sold. He is the best clickbait on the internet right now. There is no better clickbait. I was watching, I was online the other day looking at HuffPost. And I love HuffPost. I do things for them, and Arianna Huffington is a good friend of mine. But HuffPost, I counted the other day, I kid you not, Rich, on the homepage of Huffington Post, there were not one, two, or three. There were seven different Donald Trump stories on the homepage of HuffPost the other day. Seven! Now, if you go deeper into the site, there's more stuff there. But do we really need seven different Donald Trump stories on the homepage of the website? Seven? This is what it's come to.
Now, there's a body of thought which I believe is growing narrower and narrower as Iowa approaches, that when it comes down to whether it's in New Hampshire, in the ballot box, or at the caucus night in the home, that when it comes time, there are going to be a lot of people who say they support Donald Trump that are not going to stand up for him in Iowa or press the lever in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
What is your view?
I don't know. I'm not a prognosticator. It's a great question. I wish I could answer it for you. I don't know what's in people's heads or hearts or minds or souls, and so I wouldn't dare to make a guess at that. I've seen that happen in the reverse. I'm here in California where we're talking right now. I'm on my way to Tulsa, of course. But I worked for Tom Bradley, who was the late, great mayor, first and only African-American mayor of the city of Los Angeles where I live. And you recall some years ago, Tom Bradley ran for governor. We went to bed in California and across the country, for that matter. People went to bed thinking that Tom Bradley was going to be the first African-American elected governor since Reconstruction. He was going to win the California gubernatorial race against George Dukmejian. We go to bed, and all the polls indicate that Tom Bradley is going to win this and make history. We wake up the next morning, Tom Bradley has lost narrowly overnight. And we came to find out, that he lost because the folk who said they were going to vote for Tom Bradley, when they got in the booth, didn't do it. So they wanted to be politically correct, telling the pollsters that they could vote for a black governor in California. So they said all the right things to the pollsters, but when they got in the booth, those numbers just did not hold up. People did not do what they said they were going to do. So I've had the experience of being on a campaign team, being supporting a candidate, working for someone who went through that in the reverse. And so it may be the case that Donald Trump, we came to call that, by the way, the Bradley effect. It's been termed so in many political science classes and courses and books, the Bradley effect. And there were people who thought that Barack Obama might have been impacted by the Bradley effect when he ran in 2008. But he obviously pulled it off then and put it off again in 2012. So we'll see what happens with Donald Trump, but anything's possible. I just don't know on that one.
Well, let's switch to your most recent book, which is really a follow-up to some work you did over 10 years ago. 10 years ago, you were part of a conference that examined the state of blacks in America that resulted in the Covenant with Black America, a set of essays and action plans to improve the disparities in African Americans' life in areas like health care, housing, criminal justice, police accountability, education, economic opportunity, and digital access. I just say the terms, and you can hear that, like things like police accountability, nothing's improved. But how are we doing 10 years on as you revisit this?
Yeah, the short answer is that while there have been pockets of progress, certainly pockets of progress over the last 10 years since this book first came out and became a New York Times number one bestseller, so it had a huge impact a decade ago. So there have been pockets of progress, to be sure, but the sad news, Rich, is that in every leading economic category, black folk have lost ground over the last 10 years. It pains me to have to say that, but over a decade, since 2006, we have lost ground in black America in every major economic indicator category. it's hard to even wrap your brain around that, particularly that this happened, for the most part, in the era of Obama. And so the historians are going to have a very difficult time, I think, Rich, trying to juxtapose, trying to square how it is that in the era of the first black president, the bottom fell out for black America. The black America basically tanked over that 10-year period, seven or eight of those years basically on his watch. But it's a conundrum. But it says, one, that racism is still the most intractable issue in this country. It says, number two, that black people were too deferential to this president. I love him. I supported him. I voted for him a couple times like everybody else I know. And yet, sometimes you can be so deferential that it becomes detrimental. That is to say that if you are African-American and your leadership is silenced and sidelined, if everybody's too afraid to critique the president or challenge him or to push him or hold him accountable, you can be so deferential that it becomes detrimental. And thirdly, beyond the deference, there was just too much indifference. I mean, the Republican obstructionism is real. Mitch McConnell kept his word. He wanted to defeat Barack Obama at every turn. He made that commitment as minority leader when Obama was first elected. Republicans have done everything they could to be the kind of headwind preventing him from making much progress over his two terms. So I think ultimately the question is going to be, did black folk fare worse 10 years later because Obama was not bold enough, because he didn't do enough, or because he was obstructed and fought at every turn? And I think, Rich, the answer will ultimately be both.
That was my next question. Do you think it was a lack of commitment? Was it a fear of perception?
It's going to be both. It's going to be that he could have been bolder and could have been more strategic, that black people, again, could have held him more accountable and pushed him harder. I was just in a conversation the other day, you know, look at all the progress, and I'm not raising this as an example to get people's buy-in. I'm not, you know, your beliefs are your beliefs, and I'm okay with your beliefs. So it's not a question of whether or not you agree with the gay and lesbian agenda or lifestyle or demands, however you want to frame it. The point simply is, look at the progress that the LGBT community has made over the last 10 years. That all the progress gays and lesbians have made in this society, in this country over the last 10 years, and the lack of progress that black folk have made. And what I'm suggesting to you is very simply this. Gays and lesbians agree or disagree with their agenda. They made demands, and they held folk accountable, and they even had Obama evolving on the question, to use his word. But they made demands, and they didn't accept no for an answer. And the African-American community, again, so silenced, so sidelined, so deferential, that even though we are the president's most loyal constituency, not much got done.
Do you believe that he was handicapped by the fact that he was the first African-American president? The fact that he could, it was widely touted that, you know, he really can never show his temper in public for at least the first 4 to 6 years. He could never show his temper because it would play right into racial stereotypes.
There's no doubt about the fact that, again, as I said earlier, racism is still the most intractable issue in this country. No doubt about the fact that he caught hell, and some of this obstructionism has to do simply with the color of his skin, the melanin in his skin. No doubt about that in my mind. Sometimes people, you know, press you to try to prove that, and this is one of those things where you've been black long enough, you feel it. It may not be that you can put a bunch of evidence on the table, and in this case, there is evidence to put on the table. You have a white congressman stand up in front of a major address by the president and call him a liar in the middle of his talk. You look at the death threats he's received, more death threats than every American president combined. Barack Obama has had more death threats than every American president combined. And you got the Secret Service, you know, trying to figure out how to cover this guy. You got people jumping over the fence and breaking into the White House. You know, this stuff never happens. So you can't tell me this has to do just with his policies, because we always have a fight, depending on what side of the issue you're on. There's always a debate about the president's policies. But this president was subjected to a level of vitriol and disrespect that no president has ever had to deal with. And, of course, that has to do with his race. Having said that, as president, you still have to govern. You have to lead by a certain set of immutable principles. And your race notwithstanding, what do you believe? What do you believe? What is your agenda? And when you have black boys and black men being shot in the street like dogs, and cops too often getting away with this, that's a problem. When black women are still dying from preventable diseases disproportionately, that's a problem. When black children still can't get access to an equal high-quality education, that's a problem. When environmental racism in Flint, Michigan, and beyond is so prevalent, that's a problem. So at some point, race may be the reason why they're attacking you, but it has nothing to do with you, the principles that you want to govern by. And in that regard, I think the president, again, could have been more bold.
My guest today is Tavis Smiley, author, commentator, public broadcasting host. His most recent book is called The Covenant with Black American 10 Years Later. He'll receive the Tulsa City County Library's 2016 Sankofa Freedom Award Thursday evening at the Rudisill Regional Library, and he'll be in town for an appearance. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about some of those categories that you had really some of the top people in their fields write about 10 years ago, and now you've looked at new data from Indiana University to look at a lot of these areas. You mentioned police accountability. That's probably the most glaring area where we're – sometimes I wonder, are the statistics worse today, or we're just – our eyes are now open to it?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think things are not getting any better in many respects, and our eyes, thanks to social media, are much more open to seeing the suffering that some want to render invisible. So I think it's both. But there's something, you know, again, that's just strange and unsettling about the fact that in the era of the first black president, that the dignity and the sanctity and the humanity of black life could be so blatantly and violently disrespected in the way that we keep seeing it. And there are many fellow citizens who, you know, want to see this not as a pattern, but a case-by-case, you know, incident-by-incident, and I'm okay with that. But one still has to ask the question, how many incidents equal a pattern? You know, when does it become a problem? And so if you want to take them one case at a time, I think the evidence is clear that something is wrong when it comes to the sanctity, the dignity, the respect, and the humanity for black life. Now, the good news in this particular chapter, the text about police accountability, is that police departments are starting to figure out that this is no way to curry favor with the people that you're supposed to protect and serve. Put another way, you start moving toward anarchy when the public writ large doesn't believe they can trust law enforcement. And so when a few bad apples really are starting to spoil the bunch, police departments, police chiefs, police commissioners who take these issues seriously are starting to recognize now that something has to be done to make a clear distinction between community policing and policing the community. It's not policing the community. It's community policing. And the departments that understand that and that are taking that mandate seriously are starting to make the kinds of changes because, again, they recognize that you can't have the kind of power and authority and control that you need to make law enforcement work if you keep getting caught up in these situations and incidents and black folk keep getting killed in the streets. You start to have a deficiency of trust in your leadership, and that's not a good way to police any community.
Well, of course, you know, crime statistics have been going down for a decade or more, or a couple of decades, and actually they're starting to creep up a little bit in the last couple of years. But
Right. But
I think the perception of crime is that it's been growing over those last 20 years rather than declining.
Yeah, I think that is a perception.
And I think that's part of the issue is that when crime statistics first went down, I think the public at large was like, we don't care how it's getting done. We're just glad that it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always a problem for me. It's always a problem that too many of us seem unconcerned about connecting the dots for how certain things happen. It's what I said about Donald Trump earlier. He's not just magically rising in the polls. There's a reason for that. And you got to connect the dots. And when crime went down in New York City, yeah, it went down. But the price you pay for it was stop and frisk. Now, if you're a white person in New York, you know, you want crime to go down and you want to reduce by any means necessary because you ain't the one getting pulled over every other day. You're not the one being stopped and frisked. You're not the one being looked at suspiciously. You're not the one who's being held up when he's trying to get to where he needs to be or where she needs to be. So, you know, it's about respecting the humanity that we share, our common humanity. And when you are so caught up and so happy with the fact that crime has gone down, but you disconnect that from the indignity that people are forced to deal with because of a program like Stop and Frisk in New York City, then I think you missed the point of what it means to be fully human.
Let me ask you a question about a lot of these areas. Police accountability is an outlier in the fact that race is obviously front and center in that particular, and increasingly criminal justice. But in a lot of these areas, how much of it is directly causal to race, and how much of it is socioeconomic? Mm. We're 8 years out of what was the greatest decline since the Great Depression, and if the media had any teeth, we'd be calling it a depression. What mm-hmm. happened in 2008?
That's right.
How much of it is socioeconomic, health care, education?
Sure.
You know, I mean, really, education, certainly African-American households are hurting in access to quality education, but it, yeah. if you're in a poor white neighborhood, a poor Hispanic neighborhood, you know, whatever, if you're in a poor neighborhood, chances are your schools are not going to be that great.
Brilliant question, Rich. And you cannot disconnect any of these 10 issues. There are 10 covenants in this book. You cannot disconnect any of them from poverty, income inequality, and economic immobility. And note that I use all three because you can't just talk about one without mentioning the other two. It's a conversation that is about poverty, income inequality, and economic immobility. And the truth of the matter is that in America, these days, there is a highway into poverty, but barely a sidewalk out. Hmm. Poverty, put another way, I argue, is threatening our very democracy. These numbers are not sustainable, so that this becomes not just a threat to our democracy, but indeed it's a matter of national security. Because 1% of the people cannot continue to own and control 40% of the wealth. The top 400 wealthiest Americans have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million fellow citizens. So the rich keep getting richer, the poor keep getting poorer, and now what you have is an America of the rich and the rest of us. And that's a real problem. So none of these issues can be disconnected, again, from poverty, income inequality, and economic immobility. So that some of these issues are not just about race, and sometimes not even primarily about race, but more about class. There is a class war being fought in this country. It's being waged against the poor. It's hard to look at the poverty numbers and not be concerned about the future of this country. And I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about poverty in a color-coded sort of way. The problem is we think poverty, we think black, we think brown. Poverty, not that it ever was, but certainly is no longer just black and brown. This is an American catastrophe that we're about to experience, and we don't start to take seriously what to do about these growing numbers, this growing inequality. And so this really isn't I say all the time, it's not a skill problem, it's a will problem. Do we have the will to do this? I've argued in a previous book that I wrote with my friend Cornel West, a book called The Rich and the Rest of Us, that we could eradicate poverty in this country in 25 years if we wanted to. There are all kinds of plans and models and ideas about how to do that, and I'm happy to debate any of them. But we could eradicate poverty in this country in 25 years if we made it rich a priority. It's just not.
What about health care? You mentioned there have been some pockets of progress, and I would think that health care is one of those areas. Uninsured blacks in the U.S. has dropped in half with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, the rate of uninsured blacks. But, you know, to see a difference in health outcomes and life expectancy, that takes years.
Yeah, it takes time, number one. And it takes not just giving people insurance, but it takes tackling the issue of health disparities. And the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's called, does not do that at all. So I'm glad that we got something on the books. It's not what the president promised. It's too watered down for me. It's not universal care, but I'll take it, because at least it gives us something to build on and to grow from. So I'm okay with the fact we have something on the books, but it does nothing, as we detail in this text, under the health care covenant. It does nothing to address the issue of health disparities. And so there are too many black people who are losing their lives because of the incompetence, because of the lack of opportunity, because the lack of good advice from doctors and physicians, because the lack of access. There are any number of reasons why so many African Americans still die from preventable diseases. And so the issue of health disparities is a very real issue. And so, you know, the Affordable Care Act, you know, many of these provisions haven't even kicked in yet. The most important provision to me is the, you know, pre-existing conditions provision. So I suspect that in the coming months and years, when these provisions kick in, that we will see an appreciable impact, I hope, on the health of black people because of the Affordable Care Act. But at the moment, at this juncture, 10 years after that first book, that distinction beyond more black folk being covered has not been realized as yet.
You know, it's interesting. In our own city, we've had a frank conversation about the disparities in access to health care. And just about 10 years ago, we had a 14-year gap between the poorest zip code and the richest zip code in the city.
Good Lord.
And you know, the richest zip code was overwhelmingly affluent and white, and
yeah.
the lowest was overwhelmingly African American and in poverty. But we've knocked that down by 3 years over the last 10 years.
That's progress. I celebrate that. That's a beautiful thing. But
and it was $50 million to address that disparity.
Yeah.
That's what it took. And you think it's going to take that on a nationwide level?
Well, what you did in Tulsa, obviously, was to make it a priority. I said earlier that some of these issues are not skill problems, they're will problems. Do we have the will to do it? Do we care about, I repeat again, the sanctity, the dignity, the humanity of all life? See, I believe that all life is precious, and that your destiny, as Dr. King would say, is inextricably linked to my destiny. We cannot live in the same city, the same municipality of Tulsa, and literally miles apart, there's a 14-year difference in life expectancy. That's just unacceptable. See, let me put it another way, Rich. I don't believe that any of us ever comes into the fullness of our humanity unless and until we can revel in the humanity of every other fellow citizen. You will never come into the fullness of your own humanity if you cannot revel in the humanity of every other fellow citizen. And so Tulsa is not much different than most cities. You find that same kind of distinction in Chicago, in Los Angeles, all across the country. There is this divide in life expectancy between the affluent and the poor. And so I'm glad to know that you all are making progress on that. But again, somebody has to make these kinds of issues priorities.
My guest today is Tavis Smiley, commentator, public broadcasting host, and author. His latest book is titled The Covenant with Black America. 10 years later, he'll receive the Tulsa City County Library's Sankofa Freedom Award Thursday evening at the Rudisill Regional Library. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In our last minute or so, one of the areas which I thought, when I first saw the areas, I said, well, here's something we've made progress on, digital access. But your book really brought something to my idea. Yes, we've lowered the disparity in digital access, but that's all due to the cell phone. And
that's
I believe it's one of your researchers said, try filling out an online job application on a smartphone.
Or doing homework on a smartphone.
So
you're right. The digital divide still exists, Rich, but it's more class-based than race-based. It's no longer race-based, given the beautiful story you just laid out, that most black people now have access to a smartphone. So it's no longer race-based, but it is class-based, because most black folks still cannot afford a high-quality computer and printer in their home. So the divide still exists, but it's more class, because people can't afford computer and printer at home than it is race, the way it was 10 years ago.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you're bringing these issues back up and revisiting this original book 10 years ago, now 10 years later, The Covenant with Black America. Tavis Smiley, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you for the opportunity, my friend. I appreciate it.
Public broadcasting host, commentator, and author Tavis Smiley speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book is titled The Covenant with Black America, 10 Years Later. He'll be receiving the Tulsa City County Library's 2016 Sankofa Freedom Award Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at the Rudisill Regional Library. He'll be speaking, signing books, and that event is free and open to the public. More information at tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.